You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2013, a Gallup poll revealed that George W. Bush's approval ratings had increased every year since he'd left office and were up to 49%, their highest point since 2009. That trend may be unsurprising to pollsters who know that all former presidents experience a surge in popularity in the months and years after they leave office, but it can be surprising and jarring to many people who remember Bush as one of the least popular presidents of his generation. Which is why the newest biography by Jean Edward Smith, professor emeritus at the University of Toronto, couldn't have come at a better time. He's the award-winning author of Grant, FDR, and Eisenhower in War and Peace. He has called his latest book simply Bush. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Has the public forgotten the war in Iraq was unpopular worldwide and quite expensive, and yet in this presidential election, it's Hillary Clinton who's being blamed for supporting it, and recently a Trump spokesperson claimed that President Obama invaded Afghanistan.
Well, let me go back to your earlier question. Bush's approval rating has increased because he's been an exemplary ex-president. He's absolutely stayed out of public life, and I think that when you stay out of public life and don't mix in, people forget what you had done.
But can't we blame him for the quality of his paintings?
Well, I guess you could, just like you could blame Eisenhower or Churchill. That's true. But he's been an exemplary ex-president, and I think people respond to that.
Your first sentence is, rarely in the history of the United States has the nation been so ill-served as during the presidency of George W. Bush. Are you referring specifically to the war in Iraq or other aspects of his presidency as well?
Well, I think specifically to the war in Iraq. I think domestically he wasn't all that bad. If you strip out the excesses of the CIA and the NSA, but I think absolutely the war in Iraq, as I say later on, is the worst foreign policy decision ever made by an American president, and I would stick to that, and I think most people would today.
We usually associate governors usually run on the idea that they've already had that kind of executive experience. But isn't Texas a special case?
Texas is indeed a special case. Most political scientists who look at these things rank the governorship of Texas as the weakest in the nation. This is as a result of the change in the Texas Constitution during the Reconstruction, after the Civil War. During the Reconstruction period, the governor had a great deal of power. And to move away from Reconstruction and into what followed, Texas changed their constitution, and so the governor of Texas is simply a ceremonial figure, very much like the Queen of England.
Did Bush bring his management style from Texas into the White House?
Well, if you can call that a management style, yes. There was no management style, other than his own office. The governor of Texas has no managerial duties whatever.
At the time of his inauguration, he saw himself as the nation's CEO. And now we have another Republican candidate making a similar claim. Do you see any similarities between them?
Let me defer that question.
Bush attended no meetings of the National Security Council in the 7 months prior to 9/11/2001. Do we know why?
Well, other than the first one he attended and said he wasn't going to attend anymore because he wasn't interested in foreign policy. He knew very little about foreign policy, and he left that to Condoleezza Rice to meet with the other members of the members of the National Security Council. And he was concerned with domestic issues. He was concerned with the tax cut. He was concerned with No Child Left Behind, and so, with one exception, he was not concerned with foreign policy.
And what was that one exception?
The one exception had to do with North Korea, and it's a continuing issue. In 1994, the Clinton administration and South Korea started negotiations with North Korea, by which North Korea would renounce its nuclear arsenal, and the United States and South Korea would provide economic assistance. Madeleine Albright, the outgoing Secretary of State, went to Pyongyang, North Korea, in December of 2000, and in March of 2001, the head of South Korea came to the United States, and they believed that they had an absolute agreement by which North Korea would renounce nuclear weapons. And that's the one exception. Bush rejected it. Bush said the North Koreans are evil. We need a new government. And Bush blew the whistle on that. And
was that a unilateral decision?
That was a unilateral decision made by Bush. In fact, it caught Secretary of State Colin Powell off base. If you recall, Powell made the statement that we're going to continue, and then he had to retreat in public from his public statement. Yes, it was a unilateral decision. Bush felt that the North Koreans were evil, and we've inherited that today, 16 years later.
And we can only imagine what might have happened if the situation had changed and what it would be like for North Koreans today. It might be just as bad, or North Korea might have been open more to the rest of the world.
Well, I think it would have been open more to the rest of the world. They would have signed a peace treaty with South Korea. The South Koreans and the United States would have provided economic assistance. Life would be much better for the North Koreans today.
Religion was a key element of the way he ran his presidency. When did he first embrace evangelical Christianity?
When he was about 40 years old, he credited he discovered it back in Texas, and he became a born again Christian. And
this is because he had such a wild youth, and this was a way of changing around, retaking his life.
Absolutely, he was a heavy drinker. He had used drugs, and he suddenly found religion, found Christ, became a born again Christian, and dedicated himself to that.
And he filled his inauguration speech with religious references.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I think there were 14 or 15.
Were any of his cabinet or staff picks guided by his religious beliefs?
Ashworth, the Attorney General, who was also an evangelical Christian. You recall that Ashworth draped the statue of justice in the Department of Justice, mm-hmm. who had a bare chest, and covered that. And
luckily, he was not a museum curator.
I guess that's true.
You suggest that Bush's religious mindset explains why he often didn't listen to advisors when he made important national security decisions.
That's right. He was listening to God.
He said he was an agent of God's will.
Yes, he genuinely believed he was an agent of God's will. And
how do we know that?
He has said it many times.
Oh, okay.
He has said it many times, and it's amazing that the problem that we have with North Korea today is directly attributable to that, which was that was his really only serious foreign policy decision in that first before 9/11, and it was terrible.
My guest is Gene Edward Smith, whose latest book is simply called Bush. How did those deeply held religious beliefs square with the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay that included indefinite detention and torture?
They were the servants. They were agents of the devil, and in that case, no holes are barred. That's behind all of the other abuses that the Bush administration undertook.
Now, many people believe that Vice President Cheney was pulling the strings. And he was the one who really engineered our entry into the war in Iraq. But you don't agree?
Absolutely not. Cheney was very important when Bush took office. Cheney had experience in Washington. Cheney selected most of the cabinet and the sub-cabinet. And up until 9/11, Cheney played a very important role. But with 9/11, the president became commander-in-chief. The vice president is not really in the chain of command. Cheney's role diminished significantly after 9/11, and of course the Scooter Libby affair diminished it further.
But he definitely was one of the people who believed we should go to war with Iraq.
Yes.
And there were any number of other advisors who believed that. Paul Wolfowitz, Elliot Abrams, there's a pretty long list.
Oh, yes.
So Bush didn't really care what they thought?
Well, he didn't need to listen to them because they agreed with what he was doing, but they did not they were not the instigators of policy. They were able to justify what the president was doing. They were able to put a wax on it and to merchandise it. But this was Bush's decision himself.
Where did the idea that he intended to bring democracy to Iraq come from?
That's a very good question. The military went into Iraq assuming that they were simply going to liberate Iraq and be out within 90 days. And on the flight deck of the Abraham Lincoln on March 1st, 2003, Bush announced that we were going to bring democracy to Iraq. That caught everyone off base.
He hadn't checked that with his advisors?
He had not checked that with his advisors. He may have checked it with Condoleezza Rice. And we, maybe we should talk a little bit about the growth of the National Security Council, because he may have checked it with Condoleezza Rice, but he did not check it with Colin Powell or with Don Rumsfeld.
You think he was purposely keeping it from them?
No, I think he came to that at the last minute, and I don't think he understood the difference.
Right before the invasion of Iraq, President Bush said that one reason that this war was so important would be that it would free the Iraqis from the rule of Saddam Hussein. Did he really see that as a priority?
Well, freeing it from Saddam Hussein doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to bring democracy to Iraq. And that's what the military, once they removed Saddam Hussein, that's what the military did. The Ba'athist Party was still in place. The Iraqi army was still in place. And they were working on a leadership council to take over. And this would simply have been pretty much a continuation of Ba'athist control without Saddam.
Many people suggested that, at the time anyway, that Bush was completing or continuing his father's Gulf War. That his father's Gulf War had ended without really a serious resolution, and he was going to go in there and complete it.
That could well be, and
this is a problem when we psychologize about.
Well, I think so, and that's something that we will never know. Now, I should also point out that Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense at the time of his father's war, so you've got that in there as well.
Were the Joint Chiefs of Staff involved at all in Bush's decision to invade or his decision to build a democratic government in Iraq?
They certainly were not involved in his decision to build a democratic government, and they were brought in later after the planning was underway on the invasion. They were not immediate. This was not something that took place in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I don't think most Americans are aware of the fact that in 1986, under the Goldwater-Nichols Act, the Joint Chiefs are no longer in the chain of command. The chain of command goes from the president to the Secretary of Defense to the area commander. And the Joint Chiefs are not in the area command. It's like in World War II, if Roosevelt to Stimson to Eisenhower, and George Marshall is not there. Mm-hmm. The Goldwater-Nichols Act is a very peculiar act.
What was President Bush's day-to-day role in implementing his foreign policy? Was he micromanaging, or because the sense we have of him is that he was kind of hands-off?
I think that's true. I think he was hands-off. I don't think he was micromanaging. He was not like Lyndon Johnson, say, at the time of the Vietnam War. I think he was hands off. Most presidents take that position, I think.
My guest is Gene Edward Smith, the professor emeritus at the University of Toronto. He's also been a visiting scholar or professor at Columbia, Princeton, Georgetown, Marshall University, and the author of a number of presidential biographies. The most recent, Bush. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Gene Edward Smith. His latest presidential biography is Bush. It is published by Simon & Schuster. He called himself the war president. Has any other president given himself that kind of title?
Not that I know of. I'm sure that neither Lincoln nor Wilson or Roosevelt would have called themselves the war president.
And it suggests that he came into office wanting to find a way to wage war, but is that likely?
No, I don't think so. I think that he simply took advantage of 9/11 to make war, but I don't think he came to office with that intent, because that's why he concentrated on domestic affairs. Not international affairs initially.
And when 9/11 occurred, there was that brief time when he didn't seem to even want to address it.
Well, that's quite right. He was taken by surprise by 9/11, and the first day was in a great deal of shock. He rallied from that and turned it into a rallying cry, and 2 years later took the United States to war.
You said that George Bush was relatively uninterested in national security before 9/11. Does that mean that he was ignoring reports about Osama bin Laden and potential terrorist attacks on U.S. soil?
Absolutely. The CIA briefed him any number of times concerning that before the election, and Bush essentially paid no attention to it.
So he shouldn't have been taken by surprise if he had just been simply listening to what was coming on? But where was Condoleezza Rice in all of this?
Well, don't forget, Condoleezza Rice's background is in U.S.-Soviet relations, and this was also very new to her. And the people who handled that under the Clinton administration despaired, really, because neither Condoleezza nor the president was in the least bit interested in that area.
Whereas Bill Clinton had actually tried to kill Osama bin Laden, a poor job, but he tried anyway.
Yeah. And
they were getting warnings, weren't they?
They were.
So what was happening when the CIA came to them with all this information? Did they just ignore it?
They listened, and I guess you could say they ignored it, yes. So they took no action.
What role did Bush play in the creation of the Patriot Act?
The Patriot Act was really withdrawn by Ashcroft and the Justice Department. I think Ashcroft knew what Bush wanted and moved on from there.
When it finally, when a policy was finally established, was the approach, the global war on terrorism, unique to the Bush administration, or was it a continuation to some degree of his father's and Bill Clinton's foreign policy?
Oh, it wasn't a continuation of his father's, and certainly not of Bill Clinton's either. This was new. The war on terror. This is a Bush creation.
We have a call from Adriana in Manhattan who wants to help me out here with a good question. Hi, Adriana.
Hello.
Adriano, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering if George W. Bush became religious for political reasons, just like a matter of preparation for his candidacy, or he became religious just because he liked God.
Well,
he needed that constituent, the evangelical people to vote for him.
No, George Bush became a born-again Christian long before he went into politics. His personal life was a mess. He was a drunk. He used drugs. And I think he found God to bring himself back onto the straight and narrow. And this was while Bush was still in Texas. He was not involved in politics at all. He hadn't even run for governor of Texas, and so this is
when he was with the Texas Rangers.
It's even before that,
mm-hmm.
And I believe that he did that simply to put his life in order.
Let's get back to Iraq. You say the invasion of Iraq was easily the worst foreign policy decision ever made by an American president.
Yes,
there have been some pretty bad decisions in the past.
Well, now you tell me another foreign policy decision that
the War of 1812, I guess, the Mexican War. Spanish-American War had some pretty bad things about it.
Well, yeah.
What about Vietnam?
Well, look, the Vietnam War, that was a bad decision. But look, when the Vietnam War was over, it was over. It didn't continue to drag on. I mean, we may have lost over 50,000 troops there, but that was it. And we're now in good relations with the Vietnamese. It's one of those things that was cut and dried and closed. The Iraq War continues to this very day.
And do you see the formation of ISIS as a direct outgrowth of it?
I was just going to say that. Donald Trump blamed Hillary Clinton and Obama for the founding of ISIS. I think you really have to blame George W. Bush, because Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator, but he was a brutal dictator of a state that was secular. He maintained a lid on all of this violence. He was not involved in 9/11. Al-Qaeda had no presence in Iraq. It was simply a war of aggression that the United States undertook. And once Saddam was removed, and once we decided to build democracy, we took the lid off the sectarian violence that has resulted.
But Bush wasn't alone in wanting this war. In fact, politically in Washington, it was quite popular. We had Tony Blair supporting the concept of weapons of mass destruction that obviously didn't exist. We had the CIA giving mixed signals. So should we put the total blame on George W. Bush?
Well, let's look at those issues. Tony Blair's role in supporting it has been vigorously criticized by the Privy Council's Chilcot report. Germany, France, Russia, China, Canada wanted no part of this.
That's why we had freedom fries instead of French fries.
Well, that's exactly right. And it was a terrible thing. And I can remember going up, speaking up at West Point one day during this time, and went to the club for lunch, and we're serving freedom fries. It was a terrible thing. Bush did not have the support of the rest of the world. Tony Blair supported us, again, I believe, for religious reasons.
Before the war, Hans Blix came on our show, and he said that the CIA would tell him to check out a place where there would be weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. They would go there immediately. The place would be empty.
Yeah.
There was no way that the Iraqis could have cleared it out that quickly. So we were getting word from him and others that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and yet there were people like Dick Cheney who claim there still claim there were.
I think that's true. I mean, Blix and Elbaradi conducted a thorough investigation, found no weapons of mass destruction. Again, the French, the British, the French, the Germans, the Russians, the Chinese all knew that. But Bush ignored that.
My guest is Gene Edward Smith. His latest presidential biography is Bush. It is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. His approval ratings were astronomical at the time. Is that the reason that he got such strong support from Congress?
I think it is. Only one person voted against the war. The congresswoman from California.
And she paid a price for it, if I remember correctly.
No, I don't think so. No, she comes from a safe district. Uh-huh. She's an African-American congresswoman from California. Her career has continued. Bush was effective in molding public opinion and in getting public support for the war, and he had public support for it.
He's also been criticized for abandoning the war in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Being linked to 9/11 to go after Saddam Hussein.
Absolutely.
That priority? Was God just telling him that Iraq was the more important target?
Bush decided Iraq was a more important target, and it was Bush who was behind the invasion. It was Bush who told the military to prepare for it, and so forth and so on. So, it's very difficult for the military to fight two wars at once. And so when they were told to concentrate on Iraq, and it also comes under the Central Command, Tommy Franks became concerned with the Iraq invasion, and that was it.
You said that he was mostly interested in domestic policy before 9/11.
Yep.
But then in 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit, his response was considered inadequate? Had he abandoned domestic policy by that time?
To a large extent, yes. Once 9/11 came, and once the war in Iraq came, he became the commander-in-chief. And it was his commander-in-chief responsibilities that he devoted himself to. Now Bush, unlike, say, Lincoln, or unlike, say, Roosevelt or Eisenhower, Bush did not work a long day. And he concentrated on the war in Iraq, and that didn't leave a lot of time for other things.
He called himself the decider, and that actually yes. Many people made fun of it. But you're suggesting that he really did see himself as the decider.
Absolutely, and I'm further than that. I'm suggesting that he was the decider. Yes.
Did he defer too much on managing Hurricane Katrina, doing something similar there that to what he had done with foreign policy before 9/11?
Well, it was very similar, but I don't think he deferred. I think he just wasn't interested in it, and he I don't think he really quite understood how bad it was. He'd been briefed a number of times on it. He flew over. We remember seeing the picture of him looking out the airplane window at the damage. It was Hurricane Katrina and his response to it when his approval rating began to go down.
Much of your book focuses on foreign policy, but did the 2008 recession stem from any economic policies that he had created or promoted?
Not directly.
Because he'd made tax cuts.
He'd made tax cuts, and the budget was terribly out of kilter, but not really. And I think his response to the 2008 economic crisis shows how he had changed.
He redeemed himself to some degree.
I think he redeemed himself to some degree, and he listened. This is an instance where he listened to Hank Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury, and Ben Bernanke, who was head of the Federal Reserve, and took action really that went against his grain, that went against the grain of his thinking. The troubled asset relief program, his stepping in, and providing aid for the automobile manufacturers. These were things that went counter to his long-held beliefs, and he took that action because he listened to Bernanke and he listened to Paulson, and the only serious mistake they made was when they did not bail out Lehman Brothers, but I think that was more Hank Paulson than the president.
So was Obama taking too much credit when he came into the presidency and said he was faced with one of the worst recessions in history and that he turned it around?
Well, I think he continued to turn it around. I think you have to credit Bush with stopping it. Maybe stopping it and turning it around are two different things, but I think you have to give Bush credit for preventing it from getting worse.
As I mentioned earlier, you've written biographies of Ulysses S. Grant, FDR, Dwight Eisenhower. You write, not since the days of Franklin Roosevelt had White House decision-making been so personalized.
Yes, let's talk about that a little bit. After Roosevelt died and Truman became president, in 1947, the Republican 80th Congress passed the National Security Act, which created the National Security Council. And the purpose of that was to take power away from the White House that Roosevelt had exercised and to force the president to meet with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and others in formulating policy. Neither Truman nor Eisenhower had a National Security Advisor. And the staff of the National Security Council consisted of two or three people who simply took notes and maintained a calendar. There was no professional ability, there was no professional staff on the National Security Council under Truman and Eisenhower. John Kennedy changed that when he appointed McGeorge Bundy as his National Security Advisor, but Bundy hired a staff of about 20 professionals. Henry Kissinger became National Security Advisor to Nixon and doubled the staff to about 40. These are professional people in particular areas, and by the time that George Bush became president, the staff of the National Security Council was over 100, with another 100 people attached to it from the various agencies. The Act of 47 had been turned on its head. The Act of 47 was designed to take power away from the president, but by the time George Bush became president, the staff of the National Security Council allowed the president to make decisions from the White House, and it continues with President Obama, and it'll continue with his successor. And as I said, it's the 1947 Act turned on its head.
Every time a president gets another little bit of presidential power, he may be criticized for it, or she may be criticized for it. The door has been opened. The next president, of course, is going to want to walk through it as well.
Well, that's right, and probably expand it.
Now, did you ever get to interview George Bush for this?
I didn't. I interviewed Cheney a number of times, and Cheney said, "Why don't you go out and interview Bush? I'll set up an interview for you." And he did. And he set up an interview for me to go out to interview George Bush in Dallas. And several days before I was to take the flight out, I got a call from one of Bush's assistants who said, "The president has decided he doesn't want to see you because you wrote a book critical of his father," which I did in 1992. I published a book called George Bush's War, which was critical of George Herbert Walker Bush's decision to invade Iraq. And so the president said the fellow said, "The president doesn't want to see you." And so we left it at that. I left it at that.
But you had spoken to George H.W. Bush.
Yes, I had. Ironically, at the University of Toronto in 1997, decided to give both Bush and Gorbachev honorary degrees for ending the Cold War. Bush was coming to Toronto, and it was very unpopular in Toronto at the time because of Bush having been head of the CIA. And we had about 1,500 demonstrators on campus, and the university president said, "Gene, you're going to introduce him because you wrote a book about him." And I said, "But the book is critical." And the president said, "Well, it doesn't matter." Hmm. And so I introduced George W. Bush there and actually had dinner with him that night, and we had a nice conversation.
And just one more thing. The candidates, Republican candidates who followed Bush, McCain, Romney, and Trump, seem to have pretty much eliminated him from the history of the United States. Does this reflect a change in the Republican Party or embarrassment that he was a Republican and president?
I think it's more the latter. I think they know that he messed up as president, and I don't think they want to be attached to him. I'm not sure whether it means the Republican Party has changed very much or not, but I think Republicans running against Franklin Roosevelt didn't want to be attached to Herbert Hoover by and large. So I think it's the same thing.
Gene Edward Smith is professor emeritus at the University of Toronto and the author of a number of books about the presidency. The latest, the one we've been discussing, is called simply Bush, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you very much.